Hello and welcome to Playback. Fiona Kelly here, standing in for Marion Richardson. The announcement on Tuesday that the GAA had come to an agreement with Sky Television to buy a portion of its media rights package for the next 3 years was one which gave rise to lots of lively discussion and debate on the airwaves this week. The Director General of the GAA, Padraig Duffy, was a guest on Tuesday's Drive Time when Mary Wilson asked him about the precise financial details of that package. How much did you get?
I don't know, Mary, you're not to expect me to answer a question like that. But I would say this.
Well, you know, it's an amateur. In fairness, Padraig Duffy, you know, this is an amateur game. There are kids and there are players right around the country giving their time all of the time.
Yeah.
And in a way, they have a right to know.
No, well, you asked me what do we get from RTE or what do we get from Sky?
The whole lot, the whole package.
No, what I would say is this, that the total value of the package for all the games, from all the broadcasters, is marginally higher than we had for the previous 3 years. Our goal here was not to monetise this to its maximum. Our goal was to make our games as widely available as possible to the Irish at home and abroad, and we believe we succeeded in that.
Did you manage to do both, though? Did you manage to monetise it to its maximum and spread the word?
We have managed to slightly improve what we had in the last round, and we certainly will have succeeded in spreading the word.
What are you going to do with the money?
The money is what we always do with our money. We use our money to develop our games, to support communities throughout Ireland, to build the facilities that mark the GAA and put it apart from other sports. We've done that in the past and we'll do that in the future.
Just one final question though. Will the members, the amateur players, do they gain anything?
I think our games will gain from the fact that we're now associated with Sky Sports and our games are shown on Sky Sports. I think our members will be delighted that next year, as in the recent years, they will see more than 100 games live and free to air and additional games on subscription channels. They'll be very happy that our games are being promoted as well as they possibly can be.
And do you see a day, as Eugene McGee was envisaging earlier as well, that this is the start of Sky moving totally into Gaelic games and over the next 8 or 10 years, all games will be pay-per-view?
That won't happen. That certainly will not happen. And I'd make the point as well, in terms of TV broadcasting and how the games are shown, this technology is changing so fast. In 3 years ago, no one could have envisaged that we would have announced an agreement today with RTE Digital to make our games available all over the world on iPads, iPhones, laptops, PCs. That technology simply wasn't there. In 3 years' time, who knows what the technology would be.
The Director General of the GAA, Padraig Duffy, talking to Mary Wilson on Drive Time on Tuesday. Also on Tuesday, speaking to Sean O'Rourke on The Today Show, former Dublin footballer Michael O'Keefe gave his perspective on the deal.
There is strong grounds, Mick O'Keefe, finally, for suspecting that this may be the thin end of the wedge. They start off with just maybe 7 matches exclusive pay-per-view, and then that might go to 10, and like in 5 years' time they might be getting an exclusive right to a provincial final or something.
And I can't answer that because you just don't know how this is going to play out, but I do think there's been a level of hysteria. I don't think there's any appetite in GAA circles for a pay-for-player move to more professionals. I think the players are particularly well looked after at the moment. You know, people said in 1999 when Barry's Tea sponsored Cork that there was logos on the fronts of jerseys, that it was going to be a sea change in the GAA. It didn't make a difference. Caliber on the front of the Dubs jersey in 1991 against Meath. People said when Guinness and Bank of Ireland were pumping a lot of money into the GAA to promote in the 90s, it was going to change the face of GAA forever. People said when the GAA went to a multi-sponsor model 4 or 5 years ago, which generated an extra 3 or 4 million per annum for the GAA, that the players would have to get more money, that it was going to ruin the fabric of the GAA. The GAA is a unique organisation that does manage to walk that tightrope of amateur players who are now well looked after, which is great, and a professional, commercially driven organisation that pumps money back into the association. The people inside in the GAA, the Padraig Duffys of this world, have only good, and the GAA are good at heart. It's not an issue of trying to hit bonus targets or trying to hit targets. This is about promoting the GAA, and I think this wasn't a financially motivated decision. I think that their motives are pure. I would have, like every other GAA person, I understand the concerns, and we all have to see how this plays out.
Former Dublin footballer Michael O'Keefe talking to Sean O'Rourke on Tuesday. The subject of the Sky deal was also one which dominated all of Liveline on Wednesday and also much of the programme on Thursday. Indeed, according to my colleagues on that programme, rarely has a story ignited such a response from the public. Mary was one of the people who called in, and she wasn't one bit happy with the GAA decision.
Mary, you're an officer and a Camogie board member of the GAA club. Were you consulted?
Good afternoon, Joe. No, Joe, I wasn't consulted. And, you know, watching the television last night and watching some of the views, you know, and listening to the former Uachtaráin putting it across and, I suppose, trying to sell his side of it. You know, I am very annoyed, Joe. I mean, from my own point of view, I would be out a lot at matches, obviously, with the Camogie being my priority. And I'm also a member of my GA club. I'm very proud to be a member of my GA club. And we were reared, I suppose, with the GA and reared with the matches and going to matches and, you know, watching them on television and everything. So this is a whole new ethos, I think, for kids. I mean,
you're a member of GAA club, or an officer of on the Camogie board. What can you do about it?
Well, I don't know, really, Joe. What can I do? Because I don't think Croke Park listens. I don't think that the top level of the GAA and the association are listening to the ground, the people on the ground. I mean, as I say, were clubs consulted? Was this motion put to every GAA convention?
Well, you know, it wasn't.
It wasn't.
Yeah,
no.
We'll
sell out the Sky Sports. Like, as Miriam O'Callaghan asked the question last night, and I'm sure you've asked the question, is this the start of it? 14 matches. Irishie, you have the semi-finals and finals. I just don't agree with it. I think it's a shocking move. And as your previous gentleman has just said, long term, it's going to. It's not going to be a good move for the GAA after all. If children don't have this on their television, the families can't afford it, what's the small fella going to be doing? He's going to be playing with the iPad in the corner. He's not going to be watching Tommy Welch. He's not going to be watching Patrick Horgan. He's not going to be watching all these great footballers and hurlers. He's going to be watching something else and watching cartoons or playing out on the road, because the hurling match is not accessible and the football match is not accessible.
Okay, thanks, Mary.
Mary, a caller to Wednesday's Live Line. Thursday's Late Debate with Brian Dowling also devoted its entire programme to the topic. Although, as you'll hear, panellist Martin Breheny was critical of the amount of RTE coverage of the story.
I have to say, and I mean, without bringing a note of discord in here, I think the absolutely hysterical reaction of this station has really fired it. I mean, it has been non-stop on programmes since this was announced. And there were times I wonder, were the Angels even going to be played, or the weather forecast, we'd have another special on it. I mean, I think it's been absolutely hysterical. And it has, let's be fair, a vested interest. I mean, it's very interesting, for instance, that from 08 to 011, there were 50 games shown live. It was cut to 40 in the last deal. This was cut because the GAA felt there were actually too many games and interfering with clubs or whatever. So it's cut by from 50 to 40. I don't recall Liveline, Drive Time, Any Time, Prime Time, any of them dealing with it. And because there was no, but there was a vested interest here, and RTE have driven this relentlessly. And I've got to say that, in my view, is a factor in this.
Micheál O'Meara Herthig was another contributor to Thursday's Late Debate, and this was his assessment of the public reaction to the story.
I think part of the reaction was because it came on people unknown to them. They weren't expecting anything like that. There hadn't been a huge debate about it. And for a major one, I thought maybe it should have been brought up at Congress and the public should be alerted that a deed was about to be made and that it would be, in a way, a little break with tradition. I think that caused a good bit of the reaction. The other thing then is you would have to say that it's a great deal for those living abroad. But I would be worried about those not living abroad who live in Ireland, who will not be in a position maybe to pay for Sky, and who will not see some very, very vital games, as has been pointed out here. So for that reason, you know, I'd be curious, is there a plan to do anything for those people? The other thing then, there has been a very special relationship between RTE and the GAA. Since 1926, they have been working side by side. A lot of the time, just one broadcaster, one sports association. I hope that there's no danger that the day will come when RTE will have no games, that Sky will have taken over all. So people want to be careful and look about them. I think the GAA should also announce that after this is a three-year experiment. After that, that there'd be a full appraisal of it, and that the clubs of the country would have a voice in the decision the next time round.
Micheál O'Meara Herthig, as heard on Thursday's Late Debate. On Friday's Callan's Kicks, meanwhile, we got a flavour of what the Sky commentary is likely to sound like when it does go to air.
Welcome along to Croke's Park in Dublin for the first and what promises to be a very exciting series of games. You probably know it best as Irish football. Over here, they just call it the Gay. Sorry, the Gar. And I'm delighted to be joined for his first live broadcast of the Gay, the Gar match on Sky Sports, Ireland's leading authorities on sport, Joe Broly.
What?
Let's hope he doesn't rain on anyone's parade. Joe Broly.
What about you?
And we're also joined by Patrick Spillong.
Stilling? Stilling is your name. Stilling.
And of course, the exciting, energetic, amazing Colm O'Arc.
football.
Joe, let's start with you. What can we expect from today's gruelling encounter?
This whole venture is an aberration here. The GAA has done a deal with the devil here, selling the beautiful game out from under our noses. It's a fucking disgrace.
No, not really getting any of that, I'm afraid, Joe. Can we get an interpreter or something in here? How about you, Patrick Spillane?
You know, what Joe's saying is that there's an intensity of sentiment surrounding the issue of broadcasting Gaelic games. A serious intensity of sentiment and a tendency towards dissentient.
Okay, nobody actually told me you'd be speaking actual Gaelic on the panel. Can anyone translate you? Colm O'Rourke, have you anything to say?
Football.
Well said. With that, it's time to go live now to our first big match. And our big match commentator is John Mullane.
I tell you now here, Jeff, there's two points in it right here.
What?
Fair going there, boy. Sorry. Set those open. We'll fucking show a decision there by the referee there, boy. Oh. Do you want your goal, boy? Do you want your goal?
Okay, right. Something wrong with John's line there. We'll come back to him later.
From last night's Callan's Kicks. Another show which was talking about sports commentary this week was Friday's John Murray Show. Limerick-born BBC commentator Conor McNamara picked some of his favourite pieces from the archives. Some of them were hilarious, others a tad hysterical. All of them were passionate, but this piece, which featured BBC football correspondent Peter Jones on the day of the Hillsborough tragedy, was particularly poignant.
It would have been very easy for him to get too emotional, to maybe be upset, to maybe, you know, be angry, the kind of emotions that people would go through in that day, you know, how have these people died, how terrible it is. But he manages to keep so much in control, but yet conveying the emotion of what's happening without losing the emotional control himself, if you know what I mean. So if you ever listen to this, and just it's almost like poetry, this, and this is him on the radio speaking, you know, live on air on Sports Report on the Saturday when people would have been tuning in knowing that this terrible thing has happened, and he describes the atmosphere.
Well, I think the biggest irony is that the sun is shining now and Hillsborough's quiet, and over there to the left, the green Yorkshire hills. And who would have known that people would die here in the stadium this afternoon? I don't necessarily want to reflect on Heysel, but I was there that night broadcasting with Emlyn Hughes, and he was sitting behind me this afternoon. And after half an hour of watching stretchers going out and oxygen cylinders being brought in and ambulance sirens screaming, he touched me on the shoulder and he said, "I can't take any more." And Emlyn Hughes left. The gymnasium here at Hillsborough is being used as a mortuary for the dead. And at this moment, stewards have got little paper bags and they're gathering up the personal belongings of the spectators, and the red and white scarves of Liverpool and red and white bobble hats of Liverpool and red and white rosettes of Liverpool and nothing else. The sun shines now.
Former BBC football commentator Peter Jones and current BBC commentator Conor McNamara, as heard on Friday's John Murray Show. The controversy over the taping of telephone conversations in Garda stations around the country continued to receive extensive coverage on the airwaves this week. On Tuesday's Morning Ireland, former Irish Times editor Geraldine Kennedy told Cathal McQuilla about her story in that day's paper about an inventory of all of the recordings which she herself had seen.
In general, how would you assess the importance of the kind of information that emerges?
The important thing about the inventory is the comprehensive nature of the recordings over all those years, and how on earth any Minister for Justice over these years could not have known about it. This was all illegal recording, except for the recording of 999 calls. So how this could be going on in such a systemic way in so many Garda stations around the country, and that the leadership of the Garda Síochána did not know about it, sort of just challenges belief, really.
And then there's the question of what happened to that information, given that it was compiled in such detail in February.
Yes.
And Alan Shatter still didn't get to hear about it, apparently, until a few days ago.
That's right.
Geraldine Kennedy talking to Cathal McQuilla on Tuesday's Morning Ireland. Also on that same programme, Cathal spoke to Frank Buttimer, the solicitor for Ian Bailey, about the implications the recordings are likely to have on the Sophie Toscan du Plantier murder case.
So how long is this going to take, do you think, before it comes to court?
Well, you know, when you're dealing with the state and maybe my own situation as well, it's taken a while, but you know, you must remember the proceedings, by the way, Cathal, have been in being since 2006 or 2007. We had the interruption, people I'm sure are aware in the meantime, of the attempt by the state, well, the French state actually, to remove Mr. Bailey from the jurisdiction, and all sorts of other activities in the meantime. So it's been a great battle.
and it's ongoing. You just to return to the phone calls, I know you don't want to go into details, but you said you became aware of these formally last year, and they're referred to rather obliquely, and I think in the High Court. But on relation to the phone's material, are you satisfied you've got what's there?
Well, I have what I have. This is as much as I can tell you.
Are you satisfied with what you have?
In other words, the discovery in relation to this phones issue that you raised a year ago,
that you've got what you wanted to get.
You're asking me if I'm satisfied with what I have. I firmly believe, and my client has alleged this, that this is a gross conspiracy. In conspiratorial matters, there are many, many things, I'm sure, that went on that I would love to access, and I'm going to keep on trying.
Solicitor Frank Buttimer has heard on Tuesday's Morning Ireland. Another lawyer connected to that case was also heard on air this week. Alain Spellier, the French lawyer acting for the family of Sophie Toscan Duplantier, spoke to Áine Lawler on Monday's News at One.
The sad fact may be, at the end of all of this, Mr. Spellier, that we may never know what happened to Sophie Toscan Duplantier. We might learn something about a controversial Garda investigation that was carried out into her murder. We might learn something about that, but we may never know what happened to her that night.
We may, but we are working not to avoid that that scenario. And we believe that, for example, this dispute, this litigation between Mr. Belly and the Garda might also come to some information to light. And at least, as I told you before, if things go like there will be a trial in absentia in France, this would be very interesting because every evidence will be reviewed before the judge, before the tribunal. And that could reveal much of the case, for the case.
Material that the public still don't know.
Yes, absolutely.
Alain Spellier talking to Áine Lawler on Monday's News at One. It was 100 years this week since the foundation of Cumann na mBan. On Wednesday, the President attended a ceremony to mark that anniversary at Glasnevin Cemetery. Drive Time reporter Brian Lally was there and he spoke to some of the women in attendance who were very proud to tell him all about their revolutionary relatives.
Right, Laura. Ready, go.
My name is Anne McAuliffe and I have two aunts who have Cumann na mBan medals and my mother-in-law had three Cumann na mBan medals. My mother-in-law is supposedly have gone to Gortaglana where three young men had been shot by the Black and Tans and helped to bring their bodies back to their families. My aunts, Auntie Josie Kennelly and Auntie Mamie O'Brien, they were secretaries of the Cumanns that they were in. Yeah. And they fought and they were done gun running and they brought guns here, there and everywhere to supply to the men. And, you know, they really put themselves in danger. Yeah. Because they knew the men would be watched.
My name is Maura Deegan Kavanagh, and my Aunt Mary was very active in the 1916 Rising and was a very big associate of Countess Markovitz. But as children, we were told the stories, and we always knew about the medal, and there were a lot of other papers as well, but sadly they got destroyed during renovations of our home. Oh. The one thing for us as children was hearing of her bravery, in the sense that she rode a bicycle from Gorey to Dublin, and you know the length from Gorey to Dublin, and she carried the dispatch from the constabulary in Wexford, and she was stopped, searched in O'Connell Street, but she had this dispatch in her hair. She had a very thick bun of hair, so she had, that's where it was.
From Brian Lally's report on Drive Time on Wednesday. And for an overview of the contribution made by the women of Cumann na mBan, on the History Show last Sunday, Miles Dungan spoke to lecturer in Irish History at UCD, Conor Mulva.
I think the Cumann na mBan need to be taken more seriously than perhaps they are. The movement as it was set up received a lot of criticism, particularly from nationalist women who were, let's say, of the Irish Parliamentary Party tradition or more of the moderate or constitutional tradition, because they had done a lot of hard work over a very long period in trying to get votes for women. And for them, the suffrage issue came before the national question. However, for the people involved in Cumann na mBan, the solution of the Irish question had to precede votes for women. And this again goes back to the Home Rule Bill, because there was no provision in that bill for Ireland to make suffrage arrangements different to those of the House of Commons. They had to mirror the Westminster suffrage arrangements. So therefore, for these Irish nationalist women, secure, as they eventually went on to attempt to do, a republic, and after that, votes for women will flow from there. So this marks a key cleavage within the suffrage and within the early 20th century feminist movement at the time. So they're an extremely important movement, and I think their work, quite apart from the fundraising work, begins to prove itself to be quite active. And although they're clearly and marked out as an auxiliary doing field ambulance work primarily, they're still a key part of the paramilitary organisation.
They were trained how to use rifles though, weren't they?
They were indeed, and this is another key point. One of the distinctions that's brought out between the Irish Citizen Army and Cumann na mBan is that the Irish Citizen Army didn't make distinctions on gender and that there was equal membership for all. However, Anne Matthews herself has pointed out that the only woman on the 1915, early 1916 roll books of the Irish Citizen Army with an army number and therefore an active member was Constance Markovitch herself. So that gender divide may have existed more on paper. And in a conference recently in Kilmainham, this was again brought out by various speakers that even within the Irish Citizen Army, there was a lot of men who turned around and asked women to do women's work as they saw it, making tea and sandwiches, fundraising, these kind of issues. So that gender equality may not have existed on the ground in the Irish Citizen Army in the same way it did. Whereas in Cumann na mBan, they very much were able to clean and service rifles. They engaged in marksmanship shooting. There's a very vivid accounts of the Christmas 1915 rifle practices in the Divis Mountains in Belfast.
Conor Mulva talking to Miles Dungan on the History Show last Sunday. On Tuesday morning, lots of us were surprised and a little bit shocked to hear the news on the John Murray Show that we wouldn't be hearing the dulcet tones of Michael Murphy reading the RTÉ News ever again, since he was just about to take up a new job in Spain, reading the news in Spanish.
I'm down in Almería this morning. At 1 o'clock today, I'm going to be introduced to the members of the board of the Radio Nacional de España, which is rather like the authority, the RTÉ authority up there in Dublin. And hopefully during that lunch, I'll be signing a contract to read the news here in Spain.
In Spanish?
Yeah, in Spanish. Yes, indeed. Well, it'll be a mixture of Spanish. They're hoping for a new show, which a new channel really, Canal 6, which will be going on air on Monday the 6th of Monday the 2nd of June, and I'll be presenting the news in both English and Spanish, starting at that time, which will be good. The contract is for 5 years, and it'll be 10 days on and 10 days off. So I'll be able to get back to Dublin. I have a large psychoanalytic practice. I won't be letting the clients down. I'll be seeing them during those 10 days. So I'll be flying back and forth, essentially.
It sounds like the dream deal, Michael, given, as you say, that you have your psychoanalytical work here. And yeah. Presumably then, and I don't want to be too hard on you, but presumably you've a mastery of the Spanish language.
I have indeed. Well, I've been coming to Spain for about 20 years, John, and I had a house here, had an apartment here, and staying with a friend at the moment. So you pick up the language over the years. And if you have a good background in Latin, which I think we did, certainly in my time, sure. And, you know, it's easy. It's an easy language to learn.
So can I ask you then, just for the benefit of our listeners, as I said, we're not doubting you or anything, yeah. would you just, we say, read a current news item in Spanish for us?
Oh, God, off the top of my head, John.
Well, just something. Yeah.
Okay, I haven't done this yet. Okay, okay, off the top of my head. Hola, buenos días, soy Michael Murphy. Hoy estoy dando las noticias para Radio Nacional de España. Las dificultades que tienen que afrontar las nuevas autoridades de Kiev se multiplican. A la grave situación económica del país y la pérdida de Crimea se suman la presión militar rusa en la frontera y las desestabilizadoras diatribas del depuesto presidente Viktor Yanukovych desde Rusia. Y eso es todo por el momento en Radio Nacional de España. So, that's off the top
well
of my
done.
Head.
Hey, yeah. Round of applause.
And in case you haven't already heard our guest, the date for that broadcast was, of course, April the 1st. I don't know about you, but those brats, John Murray and Michael Murphy, had me entirely April fooled and taken in hook, line and sinker. Michael Smurfit was a guest on the Today Show on Friday to mark the publication of his autobiography, A Life Worth Living. In his interview with Sean O'Rourke, he discussed in fascinating detail his relationship with Charlie Haughey, his unforgiving business style, and how he transformed telecom during his 12 years at the helm. At this point in the interview, however, he talks about the breakdown of his marriage to his first wife, Norma.
Well, it was very painful. I had very, 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 a lot of affection for her, and but I'd fallen in love with somebody else, and I talk about the book insofar as that I had no young life. Norma was my, sort of my first girlfriend, if you will, and I didn't have a chance to spread any wild oats when I was younger, and probably middle aged, I ended up meeting this wonderful other lady called Brigida Baymark, who incidentally is never an air hostess, which has been written about extensively. I left it out.
Not that there's anything wrong with being an air hostess.
No, there isn't, but that's always that she was a beautician, actually. And two wonderful children with her, and I have six children altogether. So I've had a very, very good...
And how long were you married to Norma?
I was married to Norma for 24 years.
And then you met her for dinner to tell her you were going on another course. Tell us about that.
Yes, I met in the Cock Hardy, which was a restaurant we met at the time, and it was April the 1st. She thought it was a bad joke, and I just said, I'm sad to tell you that I'm leaving home. And she picked up a decanter of wine and poured it over me, and I said, I guess I deserve that.
Quite extraordinary. What colour was the wine?
It was definitely red.
So I presume John Howard, I think, might have been the man who might have had to come along with some tissues or napkins to retrieve that situation. I think it showed that she had a certain amount of style about the way she did that. Certainly it was dramatic.
It was dramatic, yeah. Kept the shirt for a long time too.
Were you surprised that she reacted in that fashion?
No.
Why?
I don't know why. I just wasn't surprised. I suppose I would have done the same or something similar.
And how long, you write in the book about how she is somebody you greatly admire and who is a dear and a close friend. So how long did it take to get that back on an even keel?
A bit of time, some years. But, you know, when you have four children together, four lovely children, and all trying to make their own careers in their own way, having their own families, it there's no point in fighting about some situations. We've had wonderful time together and a great part of my life, and a great part of her life. And I said in the book that I think that one of the best things that ever happened to her was actually that split, because she became her own woman.
Would she agree with you about that?
I don't know. I haven't asked her.
Michael Smurf is talking to Sean O'Rourke on Friday. Daniel O'Donnell was a guest on the Marion Finucane show last Saturday when he spoke about how he plans to take 18 months off at the end of the summer. He also spoke about how Magella has been since her operation for cancer.
She's doing good. She had, you know, the surgery over 6 weeks ago now, and she's getting to the stage, you know, where she's feeling better. I mean, obviously it's a long recovery from that surgery, but no, she's great, and I mean her attitude is very positive, and I think that's been a big plus right from the beginning, both for her and for me, you know, the way that she's dealt with it, and it certainly helped her. Now, you know, there are times when there's nothing will help, you know, when you're going through treatment or, you know, after the surgery, obviously it's a very slow, painful experience. But all in all, you know, she's been great, and we feel very fortunate that, you know, the prognosis is good, and that, please God, everything now is behind, you know, that it's more to the future we look.
Right.
And we're grateful too, I suppose, from the point of view of the break, that we're in the position to choose to take the break. We chose, when Magella was diagnosed, to continue doing what I was doing, as far as I was concerned. To
was
do
that
the shows.
Difficult?
Well, my initial thought when we were leaving the hospital after getting the diagnosis, I remember saying to Magella, you know, God, we have a lot of shows we could cancel. And she stopped me almost immediately and said no, you know. And the doctor did say, funny enough, I suppose, as we think back, you know, if you can keep everything as normal as you can, our normal, I suppose, is different to other people, and the fact that I'm away, most couples would maybe go to work in the morning, but in the evening time they would be back at home. But I think it's helped to continue because it wasn't like we hit a brick wall and didn't know where to go after that.
Yeah.
The break we're taking is a choice we're making. It's not a choice that's made for us.
Daniel O'Donnell talking to Marion Finucane last Saturday. Staying with musical guests, the band Crystal Swing were in the Mooney studio on Monday in the company of his mum Mary and sister Dervla. Derek spoke about how he first spotted his new girlfriend Claire across a field of vintage tractors.
Well, I'm going with a girl now. She only lives 15 minutes away from our place at home, and we're very early days yet. We're going out nearly 3 months. But no, we're getting on.
Has she any frontage?
What?
Any land?
Well, she is a farmer's daughter, all right. That's how I met her. Her dad had a vintage. I've vintage tractors, and she her dad had a vintage like day on his farm. So I went down with the two of my tractors and met her below there, and that's how it all started.
So you surveyed the land first.
Yeah. And what kind of tractor? Does she have her own tractor?
No, she doesn't have her own tractor. She's her own horses, all right. But no, it's her dad has the tractors.
Well, did she bring you for a ride on the horse? Did you bring her for a ride on your tractor?
I went for a ride on the horse, all right, that day, all right. But no, I didn't get her up on the tractor yet.
What's her name, Derek?
Claire was her name.
Can you imagine the poor girl having to walk into the sitting room with the two ye blonde bombshells sitting there going, are you good enough now for our Derek? How does it work? Like, it must have been intimidating for her.
Well, you know, I met Claire after a gig one night. She came to a local gig below in the Middleton Park Hotel, actually, where we filmed our last video. And she was maybe a little bit shy the first night I met her, but she came up to the house and, oh my gosh, we get on like a house on fire. She's a lovely girl, you know, and I mean, this boy has travelled the length and the breadth of the country searching for a woman, and she was on his doorstep afterwards. So
I think the way, yeah.
Well, he's
when
never
you least expect it, Derek.
Exactly.
And you were just up having a look at tractors.
Tractors, that's it.
Did you ask her out first? You saw her on the farm. What happened? She was in the field. She was riding her horse. Yeah. Her hair was blowing in the wind. She was going through the field.
And she is going to kill me.
Black Beauty music playing in the background. You thought, I'm having a bit of that.
Like, I saw her and I was like, yeah, no, she's a good looking girl. I know, she's going to kill me. But I thought she was a good looking girl.
And you said?
And but then my little cousins were there. And they were up in her pony. And then they were like, Derek, do you want to come for a spin on the pony? And I was like, sure, look, this is my perfect opportunity. So I went for a spin on the pony.
And you got chatting.
I got chatting.
And then you asked her out for a date, presumably. Did you
say we were chatting then on Facebook and that, and it was about 2 or 3 months later then that we finally met up then. And
God, you're a fast mover, aren't you?
From Monday's Mooney. There was another love story on the John Murray Show on Wednesday. The two parties involved in this case, however, were two female penguins from Ocean World in Dingle.
We've got two dear lovely girls, Missy and Penelope, who are aged 5 and 6. And for the last couple of years, they've been very interested in each other. They're always spending a lot of time together and head bowing and just sort of doing all the things that penguins do to show that they're friends. And then this year, as soon as we introduced all the nesting material for the breeding season, which starts around March, within hours, they'd picked themselves a nest and were on it together, bringing each other pebbles, and they're fiercely territorial and haven't left it since.
So these are all the signs of a very romantic relationship between the two, yeah?
Well, I think it could be. I mean, penguins are very social, gregarious animals, and so they do need the bonds of other penguins. So things that they do can be just to reinforce friendships, but the two girls definitely are showing signs of trying to mate each other, for want of putting it in a slightly more romantic terms.
Okay.
So I think it's gone a bit beyond friendship, yeah.
When you're talking about this intimacy, we don't want to go into too much detail, but you reckon there's something happening?
I think so, yeah. I mean, they're definitely trying it on with each other. They do spend an awful lot of time together, very, very close by, and they do get annoyed if the other penguins try and sort of come in and get in the way.
I see. Do they kiss?
I don't know if kiss is a word. They probably do the penguin equivalent, where they bow their heads to each other and make these cute little sort of hissy noises.
Oh, that's lovely. And is this the first time that two female penguins have got it together in Ireland?
In Ireland, as far as I'm aware, yes.
I'm just wondering, Kate, are the two related?
They're sisters.
Oh, okay, right. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, adds an extra twist to the story, okay. But it makes no difference to them whatsoever. They can't tell.
I'm glad you told us that, Kate.
Head penguin keeper at Ocean World in Dingle, Kate Hall, as heard on Wednesday's John Murray Show. The author Sebastian Barry was a guest on the Today Show on Tuesday. His new novel, The Temporary Gentleman, was very much inspired by his grandfather, and he told Sean about the very special relationship that existed between them both in his early childhood.
I think the most important thing to say about it is that for me as a child, when I was a little fellow, he was, in effect, my guardian angel, basically. And looked after me in a very particular way that I didn't even understand at the time. Because, you know, like lots of people, I was growing up in my own, a certain amount of childhood chaos. And this man, then in his late 60s, took it upon himself to, I mean, we did share a room together in the house and all the rest of it. But when he was going west to see his parents, who were elderly, in their 90s, still alive magically, he would throw me in the Cortina with him, and we do that journey west to Sligo that doesn't exist anymore because of the new roads, with the 7 mile straight somewhere beyond Kinnegad and all those magical things. And I was, you know, 6 or 7, looking out through that little diamond window of the Cortina, and he showed me his world there in Sligo and fully involved me in it. And I don't think, you know, it's not that I wouldn't have had anything to write about, but I certainly wouldn't have written many of these books without him doing that.
Sebastian Barry also spoke about how his grandfather's negative reaction to some of his early writing caused a rift between them.
Well, he was greatly shocked, and I was greatly shocked that he was greatly shocked, because I was only 22 or 3, and I just thought there's nothing, you know, I just thought there would never be anything I could do that he'd take exception to. I just thought I had carte blanche with him, heart and soul. But it was a huge lesson, and it did alter the stream of my work and what I was going to do. But and I always thought he had taken exception to that little novella I mentioned. But my lovely aunt was telling me recently that it wasn't that. It was a little story called Lamb, which was about me and him going to his mother's house. And there was the smell of boiling mutton in the house. And he took grave exception to that and was very hurt because he thought it was a comment upon his mother. And, you know, the way you hurt people is not really the blows straight to the face. Sometimes they go in around the back and you really don't know how you've hurt them. Anyway, I was so offended. He was so offended. We didn't speak. And, at that age, you think everyone's going to be there forever and live forever. But unfortunately, he died before we patched it up. But I will say, never a day has passed since his death 25 years ago that I haven't thought about him. I do revere him. It's clear from the book that he went through a particular sort of experience that is both bewildering and weakening and impossible to deal with. But at the same time, when he was much older, he did something for me that was in the realm of the angels. And I do revere him and love him still.
Sebastian Barry talking to Sean O'Rourke on Tuesday. Another great literary talent, poet John F. Dean, was a guest on last night's Godslot with Eileen Dunn, where he discussed a religious-themed edition of Poetry Ireland, which he himself has edited. Here he reads his own poem, Voice of the Unknown Soldier.
He stumped us, this Jesus of yours, with his walking on water, fandango, entrechat, glissade. Birthing, imagine, in a dark cave, out of all knowing. Then he walked the hard-baked earth of Palestine, but not as you walk or as I. For behind him the healing flowers grew, the rose bay willow herb, chamomile, the John's wort. We noted, too, that he could walk through walls, appearing suddenly in the midst of folk, as if he were always there, waiting that they might notice him. Oh yes, this too, he walked on air, leaving them gawping upwards as he rose higher and higher like a skylark, walking into the invisible. That was later. But humankind will not be cheated of its prey, for we claimed him, hailing him fast to a tree that he could not move on water, earth or air, and we buried him in the under-earth. Where, it is said, he took to walking once again, singing his lark song to the startled, to the stumped dead.
poet John F. Dean, as heard on last night's Godslot with Eileen Dunn. A Solemn Undertaking was the title of last week's documentary on One, in which Leanne O'Donnell immersed herself in the world of undertakers.
Bill and Martin Fitzgerald run their fourth generation family funeral directors in Macroom in County Cork. Martin's been in the business for over 50 years and his son Bill, married with a young family, has worked with him since he was a teenager. We were just getting settled with our tea when the phone rang. Because, of course, it always begins with the phone.
It's 24-7. Yeah, it is 24-7.
And would you have the phone on even beside the bed then?
Oh, yes. Yeah, it's just part of it. I've, you know, growing up in a house and, you know, when the phone rang before mobiles, we would have silence. You know, that was a busy house of six children, you know.
But you all jumped to a standstill kind of when the phone went.
Yeah.
And then you'd wait and find out a bit more, I suppose, when the phone went down.
Oh, yes. You'd be told who passed away and, you know.
Was it something you always knew you would do?
Kind of like my father there, similar, around 14, you'd be here, you might be just, you know, polishing the coffins or helping clean the vehicles, and it progressed on then slowly. I wasn't the greatest of students. And, I don't know, I suppose, around 16, I had kind of a draw and an ability. So I started doing a few hours. It was like a part-time job.
Do you ever get a strange reaction in your ordinary life if somebody asks you what you do and you tell them?
Well, I suppose you get kind of a mixture of both, a person that goes, oh, or else they're very inquisitive.
I think I may reluctantly fit into the inquisitive category, and I quickly come up against one of the most important traits in a good funeral director: utter discretion. And this is part of what gives the business such an air of mystery. Martin and Bill are the nicest gentlemen you could meet, but to begin with, it's a bit like interviewing a pair of secret agents.
Is that on or off?
It's on. I'll put it down.
Normally, I tell people just to ignore the microphone, and normally, they do.
Ignore this altogether.
No, I couldn't say what I'm going to say. Leave a vote over to
you. Oh, really?
No, because it's too sensitive. I'm sorry. A person wouldn't ask me a question because they know I wouldn't answer it. And then when, you know...
And did you have to learn that, or does that come naturally to you?
Well, it was very much instilled from the beginning. As I said, I'm with my father quite a few years now, and it was always instilled.
Do you ever want to be like the three monkeys? You see nothing, hear nothing, and say nothing.
From last Saturday's documentary on One, A Solemn Undertaking. The producer was Leanne O'Donnell, and the production supervisor was Sarah Blake. The actor Jared Harris, better known to fans of the TV show Mad Men as the prickly Englishman Lane Price, was a guest on Arena on Wednesday. His new movie, The Quiet Ones, is a horror flick, which prompted Sean Rocks to ask him why he goes for such extreme roles.
Not getting typecast and exercising different parts of your sort of acting muscle, if you like. You know, the attraction is to play different characters. What tends to happen is that after Mad Men, I got loads of offers to play buttoned up account executives or buttoned up businessmen or buttoned up teachers, or, you know, because they go, oh, here's a role of a repressed Englishman, let's see if Jared will do it again. You know, why do it again? It can't be better than that time. You're not working with Matt Weiner.
Talk to me a little bit about the sort of atmosphere that was created on the set of Lincoln by Steven Spielberg.
Well, first of all, I mean, you're working with a legend, Steven Spielberg. Everyone's tremendously excited about that. We also knew that this was a rare and special movie. And so there was a tremendous sense of occasion. And then, of course, there was Daniel. And you didn't meet Daniel, you met President Lincoln. And he would arrive, he'd be in character, and he would interact with you in character. And it was fantastically exciting, you know. And when I remember distinctly the first time I was waiting on set, and you suddenly go, oh my God, look, there's Abraham Lincoln picking his way across a muddy field, walking towards us. You know, it was magical.
Actor Jared Harris talking to Sean Rocks on Wednesday's Arena. Regular listeners to the Today Show will be familiar with the colourful contributions of Mary-Louise O'Donnell. This week she was set dancing in Roscommon, and as well as telling Sean O'Rourke all about it when she came into studio on Tuesday, Mary-Louise also did a bit of a demo.
You look fantastic as always, Mary Louise. And is this on the basis? Is this?
Stay back.
Well, I suppose. You know, you never reinvent the wheel in this business. It's a long time since we had set dancing on the radio, and here we are again, you know. Listen, take your...
Well, I swear to God...
Take your partner on the floor.
No, but I tell you, it'd have to be set dancing on the radio for, because I don't necessarily have the figure for the television,
well,
or it, to be visual.
It's all about the spirit, and you always
well,
have had plenty
well, it
of
is,
that.
And I tell you, spirit in
and
Ireland...
Was that, no, sorry, what you demonstrated there now, was that on the basis of just the one lesson, Marguerite?
One lesson, but I didn't have a partner, so I wasn't able to cross and twirl and full swing and walk and go up and back. And then, as Teresa Donlan would say to me, the wonderful Teresa Donlan, after she told me to stay back, go home, meaning go home means go back to your place because you're messing up the rest of the seven people. But there's a spirit alive in Ireland, and I'm very privileged sometimes to be able to catch it. And of course, I'm totally out of breath because you'll know all about exercise. That's the other thing about it. The exercise, you don't know you're getting it, you don't know you're doing it. It lifts up the mood, and it's about friendship and communication, you know, in a small town or in the middle of March. And I'm sure there's thousands of people listening in, and I know they do this and they love it and they travel. And it's a tremendous phenomenon. I would recommend it. I was thinking actually maybe going around Ireland a bit of a holiday, set dancing for the summer. I might come back a shadow of my former self.
Mary Louise O'Donnell dancing on the radio on Today with Sean O'Rourke on Tuesday. That's about my lot for this week. George Lee is up next with the business. To play us out, a young Irish band called The Eskies performed live in The John Murray Show on Friday. This is their new single called Fever. I'm Fiona Kelly. So until next week, goodbye.
Stairway, almost without a sound, pressed my nose against your window like some hungry hound. Through the glass I saw you shudder, in my breath I watched you shake, saw you break, saw you.
I can't see you anytime I want to. I can't see you anytime I please.
Oh, fever.
Fever in my brain.
Nothing ever comes of this.
Not one thing.
How can I be done with this? How can I be done with this fever?
Fever in my brain. Don't take my mind away.
There were smoke rings on the ceiling. There were scorch marks on the wall. Ghostly voices of the crackling flames that crept these halls. Oh, you thought that you could shake me. You thought that you could run. Now you're done, now you're done.
I can't see you anytime I want to. I can't see you anytime I please.
Ah, oh, fever.
Fever in my brain.
Nothing ever comes of this.
Not one thing.
How can I be done with this? How can I be done with this fever?
Fever
in my brain.